This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. A stunning win for Jeremy Corbyn in the Labour leadership race has shaken up British politics and turned prevailing Westminster wisdom on its head. So how radical is he really? And as the shadow cabinet beds in and the old guard ships out, where does Labour now stand on the key issues facing the country? Plus, order! Emails to the Prime Minister. Corbyn crowdsources questions to David Cameron. But has it really changed PMQs for the better? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian commentators, Gary Young and Anne Perkins, and Andy Beckett, who's the author of Promised You a Miracle, a new book on the last great era of turmoil in politics, the early 1980s. Welcome to you all. Now, it's been a breathless week in Westminster, where the astonishing and crushing victory of Jeremy Corbyn gave him the largest popular mandate of any Labour leader ever. But the honeymoon did not last long. A badly briefed reshuffle had him fending off accusations of sexism. Then his patriotism, his dress sense and his maturity were all called into question when he declined to sing the national anthem at a memorial service. And his new shadow chancellor had to rebut accusations that he supported the IRA. All this before he shook up PMQs with a list of questions from his inbox. Gary, we've never seen anything quite like it, have we?
Well, it's definitely different. I mean, I think a large amount of what you're talking about there in the first kind of certainly 72 hours, 96 hours is a lack of preparation, actually. I think there's a lot more cock-up than conspiracy in it. And that's not worrying. I'm increasingly coming to believe that he probably forgot to sing the national anthem, you know, that he's the kind of guy who doesn't sing the national anthem. I don't sing the national anthem. I don't stand for the national anthem, but I'm not leader of the Labour Party. And, you know, you take on the role of Her Majesty's opposition, some things you've got to do. But I think there've been a lot of missteps, and given how ungenerous certainly the media are going to be, the missteps that he couldn't afford, I think he kind of redeemed himself a bit with the PMQs. I think he found a way to be himself in that place and in that moment that was, you know, as gauche and as sincere as he is. I thought that was, you know, pretty good.
And rarely has a week been a longer time in politics.
No, it's been quite extraordinary, hasn't it? And my immediate reaction on hearing the scale of his victory, because the fact of the victory was not a surprise, was, my God, he really has broken this mould. This is, to use a nice 1980s expression, he really has. This is going to make a huge difference. And then I heard his speech, and I can't tell you his acceptance speech on Saturday. And my heart just sank. I don't think any political event has quite such a depressing effect on me. That's perhaps maybe not quite true. Kind of a good thing for May, but you know, and what we've seen since is this kind of extraordinary sort of unplanned potluck politics. And I'm not sure that you can actually run a political party like that. Not if you want people to take you seriously. I mean, there's a reason why called into being, because to operate in our political system, and I think probably in pretty well any political system, you just have to be organised. And, you know, you can have, to cite the Greek example, Varoufakis looking fantastic and cool and turning up on his motorbike and lecturing people on economics. But, you know, you still have to cut deals, make compromises, get your legislation through and sell the ideas to a very, you know, to many more than the 0.05% of the electorate who voted for Corbyn on Saturday.
They spend a lot of time blaming the media. But Andy, I wonder, isn't the new shadow cabinet, a bit of an issue here? We often have spoken on this show about Ed Miliband having difficulty getting the shadow cabinet to sell his ideas. But with Corbyn, the question is getting the shadow cabinet not to come out and slate his ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Anne and Gary that, you know, the first two or three days were quite shambolic in some ways. But I also think that had it been slicker, I think the press might have been even worse, because they would have said this is a kind of Marxist takeover, this is a kind of coup, this has been planned months in advance. I mean, when Ken Livingstone took over the GLC in 81, it was all done very, very cleverly. All the committees were filled with his people almost immediately, and the press was absolutely dire. So I don't think Corbyn can kind of win either way. But I think the drama of it is extraordinary. I mean, I was at a fringe meeting at the TUC a couple of days ago, and John McDonnell walked in his kind of V-neck jumper, hair slightly unkempt, you know, and various union leaders have been talking about the dire things they were going to do against the trade union bill, and they all just went silent. And he said, you know, I'm about to become Shadow Chancellor, and I can't believe I'm not dreaming. And it was an extraordinary moment of kind of political drama, seeing this guy there. We'll probably never see him in that V-neck jumper again. But I think the chaos has done damage, but I don't think there's any way at the moment, as British politics is constituted, for a left-wing Labour leader to behave acceptably in the eyes of the media.
But I don't think you have to be slick. I think you just have to be intelligent and maybe a bit organised. Maybe just to actually be able to see that the lights in the tunnel, you know, are actually an oncoming express train. That's the thing that I find depressing. I mean, in fairness to him, there isn't a kind of pattern for how you take over power and change policies without a party conference or without any kind of party process to allow you as a vehicle for introducing policy change. And so he's very exposed on that front. You know, he's a bit like Thatcher when she finally won in early 1975. You know, she's a kind of hostile force taking over her party, and it will take a long time for him to bed down if he's given that chance. Thatcher, of course, very nearly wasn't given that chance, but she fought for it and held it.
I mean, I think it is important to try and understand what it was that made so many people, because interestingly, the emphatic nature of his victory has been lost in the shambolic nature of his first few days. And I think that one thing...
I mean, let's just recap on it. It was roughly 60-20-20 with Liz Kendall, the Blairite candidate, reduced to a rounding error. Yeah. And you can look at the different sort of ways of cutting it. You can look at the full Labour members, the kind of so-called entryist £3 pops who were 80% for Corbyn. You can even split out the members who were loyal members who had been in the party right back in the dog days of the 2010. All of these different elements gave Corbyn a clear win. It's not a takeover. It was he's entitled to feel a win on the argument.
It was a popular mandate, and some of that is a corrective to what's gone before, which is not just the Iraq war, but a kind of an unease with the spin and the smarm and a sense of, you know, we know best. We run this party, you know, and so it was a kind of talk about the 1% and the 99%, but this was in a way a revolt against the elite of the party. And it would be ridiculous to suggest that all of this shambolic stuff is a deliberate way of him kind of doing politics as unusual. And yet there is something in the lack of organisation that I think is not going to go away, because one of the ways in which he's breaking the mould and doing things differently is kind of being reflective. And people ask him questions, and if he doesn't know the answer, he says, I don't know, I'll have to go away and think about that. You're not supposed to do that. There's not supposed to be arguments within the cabinet anymore. Yet there was a time when that was not unusual. There aren't supposed to be debates at conference. And this is part, I think, of whatever this new mould is going to be. The flip side of that is that he doesn't have to kind of make some announcement and then go back, you know, on it, you know, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later or whatever, I hope.
But I mean, for example, on Europe during the Guardian hustings, he was saying, oh, I think I'll campaign out. And then he kind of said slightly differently, like Hilary Beng on the radio, and say, we'll definitely campaign, stay in. And then he told the PLP that he thought he'd stay. He would definitely be wanting to avoid giving David Cameron a blank cheque. And then now he's had to clarify to avoid Lord Faulkner resigning or whoever
right.
it is.
And I
so
guess
he is giving the impression of zigging and zagging.
Well, I guess partly he's giving the impression of being reflective. Partly. But I guess my point is really for down the road that there'll be a debate, there'll be a discussion, And then I assume there will be policy, and then he will stand by the policy. I mean, right now, as a candidate, he said certain things, and, you know, and then he's being, you're right, he's being forced to kind of, you know, track them back or recalibrate. But I think as time goes on, there will be, I hope, there'll be discussions, there'll be debates, then there'll be policy, and then there'll be an expectation that people abide by that policy. And that's not how things have been done up till now. There's been not a discussion or a discussion amongst a handful of people and then a diktat, and then that is what the policy is, and then that's what people kind of do. And anything short of 100% loyalty is understood as a split and dissent and so on and so forth. And I think that's going to be different.
And I think a lot of what's going on at the moment, I mean, it's very exciting for us, but I wonder how remembered it's going to be down the line if Corbyn's leadership stabilises, which is a massive if. It may never stabilise, that's quite likely, but if it does, then frankly how his position changed on Europe in the first sort of 2 or 3 weeks is not going to be, I don't think it's going to be remembered. I mean, when I was watching PMQs, I was really struck looking at Corbyn, that Corbyn, his tie knot wasn't very well done, his tie was a bit loose. You know, he just looked quite messy. And I looked across at Cameron, and it made Cameron look quite odd. I was trying to look at it as a sort of slightly less political person. And it just thought Cameron suddenly looked like a rather strange creation, just so smooth and kind of perfectly, yeah, shiny, perfectly dressed. And so did the Conservative front bench suddenly look like very stylized, rather odd human beings.
And of course, he was speaking in real rhetoric, wasn't he, as well?
Which, exactly. Which and the tone seems... So I think there is a sort of challenge there for the Conservatives because they do look a bit odd all of a sudden. I mean, they look odd already to quite a lot of people, the two-thirds of people that don't vote for them. But I think Corbyn's ordinariness heightens that. And I think that's something that they'll have to think about a bit. I think Cameron maybe needs to, you know, not shave for a couple of days or get a jacket that doesn't quite
fit. That doesn't work. But the Europe thing, I think, illustrates a particular problem. Getting a message that stands up, I know that's a really alienating expression to use, but developing a policy so that it stands up under examination and in lots of different circumstances is hard work. And it takes a lot of people to argue it through. And I'm sure he can learn, but I don't think he has learned yet. And he needs to get people around him who challenge him, who can see not just through the first answer or the second answer, but the third answer and can understand how it's going to play in every dimension.
Isn't there something different about him, Gary, from, you know, people are talking about Michael Foot or, to a lesser extent, Tony Benn? Like, those people have been in the cabinet. They had to haggle and make deals that made them grumble sometimes, but they'd had to do that and make it stick. Jeremy has been a career oppositionist for a very long time. He's in his 60s. Mm. And most people in their 60s aren't very good at learning new habits.
Yeah, whoa.
I don't think, I'm sure he wasn't the left's first choice for this job.
No.
And I don't think he was even his own first choice for this job, frankly. I think that, you know, casting ourselves back to a few months ago, it was Buggins' turn. Diane Abbott did it last time. Livingston's not in the PLP. You know, it was his go.
McDonald had a couple of goes.
Yes. And that nobody saw this coming. And so he was standing to put issues on the agenda. And this is something that I think we have to kind of include in the discussion about how Jeremy Corbyn is doing, is how we think the other candidates would have done in the same situation. Mm-hmm. Because, he won something, and that meant other people lost something. And the three other candidates, to my mind, were not, particularly strong candidates with a particularly strong idea. And I don't know that the Labour Party wouldn't be in such a shambolic state, I don't think, but I don't know that it would be in a particularly strong state. The media would still be going after their patriotism and their loyalty. And I mean, they did it to Ed Miliband, they did it to Neil Kinnock, they'll do it to whoever wins. And so the truth is that Corbyn, as you suggest, he has travelled several decades in a handful of months. He wasn't supposed to be here. Nobody expected him to be here. He didn't actually stand for leader. He stood, I mean, technically he did, obviously, but he stood as the left candidate putting ideas on the agenda to start a debate, to ensure a debate that he didn't think he was going to win.
And I mean, I think the most plausible cephalological argument for Corbyn that anyone's put to me is that the sheer frailty of Labour's position, if it had been Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham, is something we've forgotten. And that what happened in Scotland could happen elsewhere if, you know, Yorkshire First or UKIP or with a working class leader or whoever comes up. Andy, you've obviously looked at a great period of political upheaval before, which has seen the left split. Do you see echoes with this, and do you think Labour's better placed now to weather the coming storm than it was in the early 80s?
I think in some ways they are better placed. I think the Conservatives are weaker institutionally now than they were in the early 80s. Although in the early 80s Thatcher was very unpopular, the Conservative press was much more red then than it is now. I think there are far fewer Conservative members. I think there's probably less talent in the Conservative Party. Thatcher, even when she was very unpopular, had some very clever people working for her. So I think the opponents are weaker, but the trade union movement is obviously about half the size that it was in the early 80s. The peace movement, although it's kind of reconstituted itself through the Stop the War campaign over Iraq, I think is much less of a sort of institutional force than it was in the early 80s. I think Corbyn's lack of kind of conventional charisma is interesting, because we've mentioned Ben briefly. I think a problem for Ben in the early 80s was that Ben was a fantastic speaker and a sort of mesmeric individual, which meant if you liked him, you really liked him. But if you didn't, you could be quite scared of him. And all those absurd pieces that were written in the right-wing press about how Ben wanted to be dictator and run the country, you know, like a sort of Soviet stooge, even though he was being elected for Parliament for 30 or 40 years before that, they had a sort of the plausibility, because Ben had the personality of someone who could have been a demagogue or a dictator, whereas Corbyn you could never present as a stooge of the Soviets, because the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, and B, he's evidently a rather mild, you know, perhaps rather stubborn character, but he's not a kind of Ben, and he's not a Livingstone either. So that brings disadvantages. He doesn't have their kind of coherence as an operator, but he has a mildness. He doesn't have an extremist personality. So people who don't follow the Labour left and you know, Corbyn's history, they just look at him and think, this guy doesn't look like a bully, and he doesn't look like an extremist in terms of his personality.
And Anne, I think that was your feeling about the Prime Minister's questions experiment, wasn't it? That he didn't come across as an ideologue in that.
No, he certainly didn't. And in lots of ways, he did look like the Woodworks lecturer, on an outing or a local radio phone-in host. And I mean, it was not ineffective, I thought. I thought it worked quite well.
Think he can keep going with it?
Well, no, I think is the answer. I mean, he'll maybe want to refine it. I thought actually there was some interesting developments. You could see that they'd thought through the fact that they couldn't just reel off one question after another. They had to have a bit of a follow-up and a bit of sort of examination of Cameron's answer. They just need to develop that. And they need to restrict the number of themes. And, maybe you could have two or three people coming at the same problem from different angles. Then you might, which if you've got 40,000 people answering, that shouldn't be too difficult. And then you might kind of really build up a discourse that tests Cameron in a way that he wasn't tested yesterday. But can I just pick up on something that Andy said, which I thought was really interesting and kind of really gets to where we are now as opposed to where we were 30 years ago. And that's that politics just isn't organised the way it was. It's just a completely different business. You've got these hollowed out parties that operate like kind of ad agencies for a particular message to which everyone has to subscribe. Curiously, I think there are talented people on both sides of the house, very talented. I think there's some interesting new appointments to the shadow cabinet, and I think there are some interesting ministers in the Tory government. But they're different. They haven't come up the way people used to come up through the trade union movement or through local government. They're just kind of all individuals. And I think that presents huge new challenges to the way politics itself is organised.
Andy, can I just say, because you were talking there about the parallels between Corbyn and the Benite left, let's just turn for a second to the other side of the Labour Party, because of course they drew stumps and walked away, didn't they, in 1981-2 with the SDP. There's some whispers of some people doing that and some funders saying, I'll give you some money. Do you think that could happen again?
It's conceivable, isn't it? Because the divide between Corbyn and some of the more right-wing New Labour lot, if we can call them that, is large. And already some people who are close to Blair, like Lord Freud, ended up moving and effectively redesigning welfare for the Conservatives. So in a way, it kind of began to happen as soon as the coalition formed. So there's been some of that. I wonder whether, given how the electoral system has just been so brutal to the smaller parties, in May, I wonder whether it's quite so appealing setting up another party as it might have been. Whereas I think in 81, a lot of people who set up the SDP really thought we're going to win a lot of seats here. Whereas coming second everywhere, which is what's happening to a lot of the smaller parties now outside Scotland, is that's very uppermost in people's minds, that fate. So people are perhaps a bit more realistic about that. Just one thing I thought about Corbyn at PMQ, to go back to that, was I thought he had the air at times of a slightly scruffy kind of accountant who's come to run his eye over the books. And I think something that's being lost in this conversation is I think the Conservatives are not necessarily in a particularly strong position. I think there are signs that the economy is cooling down. They got very few votes in the election. And I think something that might help Corbyn is that if the Conservatives run into a bit of trouble over the next 2 or 3 years, which I'm sure they will, his heir as a sort of, you know, non-ideological, sort of kindly but quite sharp old geezer might not be the worst heir to have when you're surrounded by these younger, very obviously charming people who may not have, you know, run the economy quite as well as they think they have.
But the weakness there is that you always have to have a prime minister in waiting to capitalise on the weakness of the government, and I that's where the Tories lost repeatedly, and I'm afraid I'm not yet convinced that Corbyn can persuade people that he's a prime minister.
I agree. I'm just thinking of the sort of momentum and feel of politics next 2 or 3 years. Maybe Corbyn won't be the Labour leader in 2020. But I just think there's a sort of assumption in a lot of the critique of Corbyn that the Conservatives are strong and he's just going to be crushed. And I think the Conservatives were very, very lucky in the election. They were shrewd, but they were also lucky. Things like the global oil price collapsing just before the election. That's like the opposite of the oil crisis of the 70s, which destroyed Heath. You know, that was an enormous piece of luck for Cameron.
And unemployment, which was going down and down and down, is creeping up since the election.
Yeah, and the economic cycle and the political cycle, which were working nicely in May, may not be working quite so nicely in 2020 or even long before then. So I don't think we should assume that it's kind of flaky extremists against rather sort of hard-headed centrists. I mean, the Conservatives are a bit slapdash and weak in their own ways, I think.
I want to give a final word to Gary, who is... I think from Stevenage, yes. Which is the marginal bellwether seat that we went to with Politics Weekly before the election, and got a feel that lots of people on the streets and outside the school gates weren't ready to give Ed Miliband a chance. Do you honestly believe that in the right circumstances, people in somewhere like Stevenage might be inclined to give Jeremy a go?
Honestly, I think it's unlikely. And the whole thing about Corbyn, if one is honest as a commentator, is that it's a big risk. Mm. It's a big risk. Although given the alternatives, which were no risk and kind of likely failure, I think it's a risk worth taking. I think it depends on... it's going to depend on events, really. Because speaking for the kind of people that I grew up with in Stevenage, they don't much like toffs. They don't much, you know, but they do like jobs. And they do like public services well run. They do like the National Health Service. They do like a range of things that, frankly, are not in the kind of, are not of the Tory ideological gift to give. And I remember, I was only 10, but I remember when Thatcher came in. And there was a real way in which she spoke to something elemental in the people that I grew up with. And it was the grocer's daughter, the individual against society. Cameron doesn't really have that language. And Cameron doesn't really, I don't think, relate to the kind of people that I grew up with in a way that Thatcher did. And could. And therein lies a vulnerability. Because the other comparison with the 80s that is very different is that the Tories are much ideologically weaker now than they were then. Like it or hate it, you know what Corbyn stands for. Like it or hate it, I don't really know what the Tory brand kind of is about. I knew with Thatcher, I don't know with these guys.
Brilliant. Well, my thanks to Anne, to Gary and to Andy. Andy's book, Promised You a Miracle, is out now in the Guardian Bookshop, where while you're at it, you'll also find books by Anne, Gary and yours truly. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.